For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast. I'm Claire Armistead. Suddenly it's autumn. The ground is colder, the evenings are shorter, but it's not all bad news. We're also heading for the hottest part of the publishing year, the part that makes or breaks reputations and publishers' budgets. Remember that upstart Russell Brand? Who'd have thought this time 3 years ago that My Bookie Work would become the Christmas hit of the year? But it's not all about the mass market. In this programme, Sarah Crown will be investigating how to turn a book launch into a cultural phenomenon with one of the people who does it best. And Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland will talk to literary giant David Grossman about his latest novel, out this month and already gathering a huge amount of interest. First, though, to get a handle on what autumn 2010 has in store and to give us a sense of what goes on behind the scenes, I'm joined by Benedicta Page from The Bookseller and Sarah Crown, who, of course, edits the Guardian Books website. Hello to both of you and welcome back. Now, first of all, Ben, can you tell us a little bit about why this time of year is so important?
Well, it's really about the Christmas market. A huge proportion of the entire number of books sold each year are actually bought by people in the 6 weeks right before Christmas. So obviously the publishers are very, very keen to bring out their best books for the autumn months. So really from September onwards, they are bringing out titles that they think will hit every conceivable category and really hoping to build a buzz around them and get everybody talking about them, get everybody thinking, well, that would be a good present to give to my relatives.
In terms of actually dates of publishing, it's pretty much between now and the middle of October, isn't it? What isn't out by the middle of October isn't going to make the bookshops.
Well, I think you can probably extend it a little bit longer to the start of November. But really, yes, to get the buzz going, the key dates are September and the first half of October. Yeah, you're right.
Sarah, what are your tips as a voracious reader?
Well, novel-wise, a book that's just come out this week, Jared Woodward's new novel, Nourishment. I haven't read it yet, but I absolutely loved his Jones Family trilogy. I thought they were completely fantastic, so I'm really excited about that. And in October, a new novel from Philip Roth, Nemesis. He's back in Newark in 1944. It's very familiar territory for Roth fans. And it's all about a polio epidemic that's going on then. So I'm really, really excited about that.
So, Ben, the season began with a bang this week with Tony Blair's memoirs. Nobody's calling them exactly literature, but they are a phenomenon. There are quite a lot of political books coming out in the next few months, aren't there? Is this just because of the party political season? Or is there a bigger trend, do you think, in this?
Well, you know, I think that the Blair memoirs are going to continue to dominate the autumn. I think they're going to carry on selling and people have very high hopes that that is going to be one of the biggest titles at Christmas.
Will it outsell Mandelson? Because Mandelson's been doing huge business.
I think so. Yes, Mandelson's been a surprisingly strong seller in the bookshops. I think retailers were expecting it to do quite well, but it's done much better than they thought it would. But on early showing, Blair is performing much, much more strongly even than Mandelson. So we are expecting that that's going to be massive. But you are quite right, there are indeed other titles out there. And perhaps slightly ironically, George Bush also has his autobiography. Well, it's not a traditional autobiography, it's called Decision Points. And apparently it takes the sort of 14 key decisions that he had to make while in office and explores all of those. But that is going to come out here in November, I think. So no doubt there'll be much more discussion then. And there are also books. There's a book on the economy by Gordon Brown, looking at the financial crisis. Will Hutton is writing about equality.
And he's, of course, he was an architect of the Third Way, wasn't
yes,
he? So people will be interested to know what he has to say at this point in history.
Yes, I think there's going to be a lot of discussion. I mean, obviously, it's a very interesting time politically now anyway. With the coalition, we're in slightly new political territory. I think there's a lot up for discussion, both looking at the past, looking at the present, looking at the future after the financial crisis. So I think, there's going to be a lot of interest in politics books this autumn.
But Sarah, what we're really interested in on this podcast is literature. So talk a bit about the literary titles.
Okay, well, as well as the novels that I mentioned, in poetry, Seamus Heaney has just brought out a new collection, Human Chain. That apparently is doing very, very well in terms of sales, which is lovely.
It's right up in the top of the charts, isn't it?
I think it's at number 6 in the charts, which is incredible. I mean, that's just gobsmacking for a poetry book. So, and just brilliant to hear that one's doing so well. So that's poetry. Then looking into October, a book that I'm quite keen on is Peter Ackroyd's latest, The English Ghost. And this is a collection of ghost sightings over the centuries. Apparently, according to Ackroyd, the English see more ghosts than any other nation. And he takes us on a tour of them. It's like a treasury of ghost sightings, I suppose. And I think that sounds lovely and spooky and autumnal. So I'm really excited about that.
Yes, and there's another book from Peter Ackroyd this autumn. Apparently, he's got a retelling of Malory's Morte d'Arthur.
Oh, really?
Yeah, King Arthur and the Holy Grail. So that should be fantastic.
Yeah, again, it has that kind of cosy, wintry, yes, snuggling up by the fire feel. And then the other one, again, looking sort of further forward into November, Jeff Dyer has a new book out. It's a collection of essays and journalism called Working the Room. His last book, Death in Venice, Jeff in Varanasi, was a novel of sorts. But this one is going to appeal to people who like books of his, such as his photography book, The Ongoing Moment.
And on that hybrid line, we've also got Will Self's Walking to Hollywood. I mean, Will Self has a huge fan base, doesn't he? These are what we would call Marmite writers, aren't they? People
Absolutely,
either love them or hate them.
Yeah.
We rather love them.
Yes.
Ben, that takes us neatly into the Christmas bestsellers. What do you think they're going to be this year?
Obviously, there are going to be some of the big brand authors like Terry Pratchett, Sophie Kinsella. All of that is going ahead this autumn. But you particularly associate Christmas, of course, with the celebrity autobiography, or you have done in recent years, that's for sure. And this year is no exception. Last year, they didn't perform all that well. And there was a lot of debate within the trade as to whether they had outlived their time. People had lost interest because of the recession and all the people's glamorous lives. But I think we've very much come to the conclusion that it was just a rather lacklustre offering last year. And this year, people are very confident. There are a number of really strong titles and also really different kinds of people writing their memoirs. We've got Stephen Fry, The Fry Chronicles, Alan Sugar, Lord Sugar of Clapton, I should say, with his life story, which I think will be really interesting. Got Judy Dench, Michael Caine, Keith Richards, Michael McIntyre, the comedian, of course, also Simon Pegg. So it's a real range, and I think we're going to see much, much stronger performance from the celebs this autumn, which will make the booksellers very happy anyway.
And I should perhaps at this point chip in and say that if memoirs are your thing and none of those people appeal, then Gunter Grass's new memoir is coming out in November, The Box. It's the sequel to Peeling the Onion. I know.
We're always high-minded on this podcast. And actually, if I were a betting woman, I'd take a punt on Neil McGregor's A History of the World in 100 Objects as the home county's stocking filler of choice. This is partly based on his incredible popularity in Hay, where he was a sort of rock star. He called there all these people who used to buy Kenneth Clark and Jacob Bronowski, and who've heard Nuggets on Radio 4. I bet they're going to be rushing out to buy that. Now, I'd like to draw your attention to Romantic Moderns, which I've got here, actually. It's a really beautiful book, and it's on the long list for the Guardian First Book Award, although it's actually not published till October. Just look at that, Ben. That's class, isn't it? Look at
gorgeous.
The pictures, the quality
yeah,
of the
lovely.
Paper.
And
isn't
papers.
That just the sort of thing you want to give your mum for Christmas? Or even yourself? Sarah, quite a lot of the novels on this list are not published until this season, so they're not out yet.
Yes, so in the next couple of weeks we have Mr. Chartwell by Rebecca Hunt, and that's a novel on the subject of Churchill's black dog. That's a metaphor for his depression, isn't it?
But it actually is made actual.
Yeah.
It's the most unlikely subject, but there you go.
And then another novel, an apocalyptic one this time, from an Australian-based American called Stephen Amsterdam, so that's a lot of different countries in there, called Things We Didn't See Coming. And then finally, Your Presence is Requested at Savanto, which is an amazing novel set in a convalescent hospital in Finland in the 1920s. So they're ones to look out for. And also another person on the First Book Award longlist who's garnering a lot of attention outside of the longlist is Ned Bowman. His novel Box of Beetle has been nominated several times over in our Not the Booker Prize, which we run on the Guardian website, where we ask people on the blog to nominate novels that they wish had been on the Booker long list. And his has come up several times. So I imagine that's going to be quite a big book this autumn as well, from the sound of things.
I find it so fascinating the way some books just get the wind in their sails. And it's not predictable, is it? Particularly with first books. Is he well connected?
Not as far as I know. But he used to blog for me, actually, back in the day. So I'd like to claim the prize of launching him onto the literary scene.
And the Guardian First Book Prize list is now being digested by Waterstones reading groups across the country, who'll no doubt have their usual wide and salty range of opinions. But speaking of books that get the wind in their sails, one American writer whose sails have been very full recently is Jonathan Franzen. His novel Freedom isn't out till the end of this month, but we've all been talking it up a storm here at The Guardian. It's 9 years since his last novel, The Corrections, was published, so it's been a long wait, and it's upon that novel that his sizeable reputation stands. Nick Pearson at Fourth Estate is Franzen's UK publisher and has masterminded the campaign for both novels. Sarah, you met Nick in the London Review bookshop to find out his strategy for getting the word out about this unknown author all those years ago. Here's what happened.
We had a moment a few weeks after we had acquired that book for Fourth Estate. We had a ghastly Fourth Estate away day where we sat around in a garden trying to predict trends for the future and all that sort of nonsense. And then we went and had some lunch, about 16 of us. And a conversation after lunch turned to our upcoming books. And naturally, conversation turned to the corrections, how we might publish it, how still months away from publication day. And I will never forget it, because I suddenly realised that of the 16 people around this table, all, I think, bar one, had read this book. And all talked about this book, or the people in this book, if you remember, it's about a family from the Midwest, Alfred and Enid and their three children, as if they were their own families. And I just sat back and listened to everybody talking about this thing, the corrections, as if it was part of their own lives. And I did think, oh my God, I think this is going to work. And we never actually talked about how we were going to publish the book that day. We never got round to it. But what it made me realise is that we just needed to do it in a rather old-fashioned way and make lots and lots of proofs. If it was having this effect on my colleagues, I just had to get the ball rolling and get people reading it. And that's what we did. We just did lots and lots of proofs. And the reaction began to spill out in that way beyond the publishing house. It was very exciting.
And so fast forward to the present day, and you have the next Franzen novel. We've had to wait 10 years for it, but here it is. And have you gone down the same path of just making sure, has that been your approach this time, to get everyone to read it?
We've done the same thing, to be frank with you. We've just made an awful lot of proofs. People have been reading it all year. I think people love it as much as I do, and we go from there. It's about dropping a little pebble in a pond and getting those ripples moving out. Mm. To be frank with you, it's word of mouth in the end. These great books, it's word of mouth that makes them read.
Can I ask how many proofs you think you sent out in the end?
Hundreds. We sent proofs to just about every bookshop in the country.
That's really interesting that you sent them out as well as to journalists. You sent them out to the people who are actually going to be selling.
Oh yes, and that's very important.
So it's interesting that this is a quintessentially 21st century novel, but you've really
published in rather
gone
an old-fashioned way.
Back to basics with your marketing technique. And now we are in the LRB bookshop. So what we thought we'd do is just have a walk around and see how successful your campaign for this book has been, and ask some people whether they've heard of it and whether or not they're excited about reading it come September the 23rd.
Oh, blimey. All right.
Have you heard of Jonathan Franzen's new novel, Freedom?
Yes.
And what have you heard about it?
That it's had rave reviews in America.
And do you think you'll buy it, read it?
When it gets to the Oxfam shop, yes.
I haven't.
No.
I've heard of it. Might read it.
I think I've just seen it in bookshops.
Have you heard of Jonathan Franzen's new novel, Freedom?
Yes.
And what have you heard about it?
Very little. I know who Jonathan Franzen is.
Will you be reading it, do you think?
I have a bookshop. I have a lot of books. So I might read it.
Well, the buzz might not yet have reached all the readers, but let's see what the booksellers have to say about it.
I'm Julie Kingsford, Head of Marketing at Foyles Bookshops. With Freedom, we got sent proof copies pretty early, but it really means so much to booksellers to be able to get their hands on a book and read it, because that's what it comes down to when you're selling a book. If you haven't read it, you can still recommend a book to somebody, but you say to people, honestly, I haven't read it, I don't know, this is what the hype is. Whereas if you've read it yourself, then you can hand in your heart, say, this is an amazing book, and that's sort of the bread and butter of good old-fashioned bookselling.
My name's John Creasy, I'm the manager of the London Review Bookshop. For us, it'll be a very important book. We expect to do very well with it. We'll be putting it in the window, we'll promote it, but mainly we'll be promoting it on our website and in our catalogue.
We are doing a lot more with it than we do with a lot of fiction. I mean, Franzen's somebody who sells for us a lot. Our customers really respond to him. We're doing an enormous and beautiful window display, which our designer's working on at the moment, in an attempt to sort of it creates a little bit more than just, you know, a poster about a book in the window. And we really want it to feel more exciting and interesting than that.
Hi, my name is Glenn. I'm the new title buyer at Blackwell's on Charing Cross Road. For most serious book lovers, this is like the book of like the autumn and Christmas period. We'll promote it heavily, it'll be in the window and things, but I would expect it to sell without the need for too much of a push. I know sometimes I think, you know, publicity or marketing, it's easy for them, and I think in this case it is just like an easy thing. You just get the proofs out, people will read it, and it would kind of generate its own momentum, I think. You know, he is a great American novelist. It's going to be big news.
You heard it here first. Well, almost. Now, David Grossman is one of Israel's most celebrated novelists. He's a vocal opponent of his country's policy towards the Palestinians, and his new novel is called To the End of the Land. It's about a middle-aged woman, Aura, whose son is fighting on the front line. The book is a memoir to his own son, who was killed while serving in the army. Jonathan Friedland talked to him.
The central character, Aura, who dominates the book, it's her fears, her dreams, and her thoughts that are running all the way through the book from beginning to end. Some of the early critics of the book have said that she is your Madame Bovary or Anna Karenina.
She's my Aura.
She's your Aura. She's
my
your
Aura
creation.
in any sense.
She emerges on the page anyway, so fully formed, such a real and sort of textured person. Where did she come from?
Well, you know, people ask me how can a man write a woman in such a way, and I say I just surrender to her option in me. I just surrender to the option of Aura. And she has all, I mean, she's not a perfect person. And I think that's what makes her so real to people. This imperfectness of her, these inner contradictions and her moods and her impulsive, sometimes stupid reactions, and this mixture of banality and originality and all that, which, I mean, everyone knows people like her. She's a very Israeli character, and in a way I think she also reminds us of Israel in general.
I agree that she's very Israeli. Say how she reminds us of Israel in general.
Well, I think the way she navigates between fears and hopes, for example, between being a very moral, deeply moral person and can do and say the most outrageous, politically incorrect things, being you know, subject to her deepest fears and suspicion and racism even against the Arabs, and at the same time doing, you know, after her son Ofer did this unbearable thing in Hebron, or collaborated with something, you know, forgetting an old Palestinian in a huge refrigerator, eventually he came out of this refrigerator, but he was heavily damaged.
Her son Ofer is a soldier in the Israeli army, and he's done army service in occupied territories.
And when she hears that, she freaks out. She cannot bear the thought that it happened to Ofer, this moral, sweet, tender, very attentive human being. And how can it be? And she starts taking bus number 18. And this was the bus that was most frequently exploded during the time of the suicide bombers in the 90s. And she goes on this bus and she travels for an hour or 2 hours, and she goes down not knowing what she was doing, in a way hoping to get exploded. You know, now this is a very radical act that she does. But you feel that it comes from a developed moral person. Yes, she feels that she has to pay for something. I do not share what she did, yes, but she has it. She has this option.
And when you say very Israeli in a way, that relationship of feeling horrified by what our wonderful young men and women are doing, holding both attitudes at once, knowing that things are going on in the occupied territories, and yet feeling these are our sons and daughters, these 18, 19-year-olds, and they're wonderful, young, moral people, and not putting the two together. In that sense, she would be typical of many Israeli parents, I suppose.
Yeah.
We should say something about the sort of premise of the book. It is that her son, who has actually completed his military service, volunteers to go back into active duty, and she is fearful for what might happen to him, and almost as a kind of superstitious way of preventing, the phrase uses magical thinking. She thinks, if I'm away and go on the walking holiday in the northern Israel and the Galil region that we were going to do together, then perhaps nothing can, no harm can come to him. After all, I won't be here if the notifiers, the people who come and tell parents of the death of their children, if they come, there'll be nobody home. So that's the sort of premise for what happens. What struck me about the book is there is a kind of air of melancholy and of wistfulness that hovers over the book from the very beginning, of remembering a time that has passed, of loss, not just in terms of loss of life, but loss of childhood, of loss of those moments when a child is very young, that is in the book from the very beginning. And we're going to come to talk about what happened to you and your family. But you started the book in 2003, before yes. those events. And yet the book is absolutely infused, it seemed to me, with this kind of wistful melancholy, even from the very prologue, right at the beginning yeah. of the book, when we establish Aura and her, the two men in her life.
I think it has both. I mean, it has this melancholy melody in it of mourning something that has gone and passed, which is something that I felt then, even before everything happened, I felt towards Israel and towards the dream that we had, which was a lofty dream in my eyes. And it was also to mourn the hope that we had then. But it's also a book about the wholeness of life and everything life can suggest, and about the wholeness of life of a family and the drama of the family. These are things that fascinate me. And of course, I started writing it in 2003, and in 2006, August 12, during the last hours of the War of Lebanon, we lost our son, Uri, who was a fighter there in Lebanon. And I guess it had its impact. You know, I mean, it's also about the ending of a family as it used to be. But it is not something that is very specific for me only. So many thousands of people in Israel, they have experienced the same thing. And we raise up our children in this deep fear and in this feeling that they are only borrowed for us.
The thing that is sort of uncanny is that the very thing that powers Aura in the novel, this fear of the knock on the door to say that her son is lost, yeah. is then what happened to you midway through writing her story. And she had feared, had some of this magical thinking that somehow, as long as she was away, it couldn't happen. And you yourself had a similar relationship with the writing of the book and your own fears for what might happen to Uri, your son, in the army.
I had this magical thinking, but I knew it is magical thinking. I did not, and I do not believe that words can really protect life when you are in the heart of war. But it was a way to do what I can do in order to protect.
What we're referring to is this belief you had that maybe as long as you were writing this book, no harm would come to Uri.
Well, it's still very hard for me to talk about what I have felt back then. I can say now is that when I wrote, I had a feeling that I can be with him as much as I can. When I wrote, he was a soldier in the army, in the occupied territories, and I felt it is at least my duty to accompany him through writing and to do it. And maybe like Aura, you know, Aura, she goes and she tells her partner in this walk, Avram, the love of her life, who is not her husband, but very close to her in many ways. And she tells him the smallest details about Ofer, the little details, you know, the little facts, the little many acts and deeds and efforts that we do in order to accumulate one human being in this world.
The day he took his first steps as a baby.
Yeah, yeah. Everything, you know, all these domestic or familial miracles of creating a human being in this world. And she feels that by telling these facts, she in a way, builds a kind of a wall around him to envelop him, to protect him. This is the only thing she can do. She cannot do much more than that. But, you know, when existential danger hovers above the head of someone we love, we feel that all the effort we have invested in order to make him what he is, that it fades out, that suddenly nothing can help in front of the harshness, the brutality of war. And what she does, what Aura does, is to reinfuse life and strength and energy and protection into all these thousand small details. And this book is very much about the miracle of the family and about how, I will use the term, heroic it is to maintain a routine of a family in the midst of such unbearable reality like our reality.
One thing that really struck me in the interview you gave to Rachel Cook of The Observer was you talked about how you returned to writing the book even after the Shiva period, the period of mourning, just 7 days, had passed after Uri's death, and you went back to the book. Just tell us a bit about how you were able to do that and also the place that writing has actually in your own life, in your daily routine, in your own sort of composition of yourself as a human being.
For me, writing always was the way to find my place in the world and to understand the world. So many things I do not understand unless I write them. I mean, in a very stupid way, maybe, but I need to write them and to make them into a form of a story and to split the experience of life among different characters. And only then I can really envelop a situation and understand it. Of course, after what had happened, I think my instinctive choice was to go back to writing. Because the basic feeling after something like that happens to you is that you feel exiled from everything that you knew beforehand. Nothing is taken for granted. The most primal, basic things are dubious suddenly. And going back to writing was a way of recreating, you know, a home in this chaos. And I sat and I wrote, and the chutzpah even to insist on writing or finding the right, the correct word for the nuance of feeling that I wanted to describe, to insist on it and to know that it's so crazy to do it when the whole world falls apart around me. And yet when I found the word, there was this slight satisfaction of doing the right thing in the heart of this chaos. And then to be able to invent characters, to invent situations, to infuse life and passion and love and imagination into characters and into words even. That was a way of choosing life again. I'm in a different place today. It's 4 years, and I know deeply that writing was really one of the best instruments, I will use this terrible mechanical term, to find my place again.
That was Jonathan Friedland with David Grossman, and you can hear the full length of that interview on the book's website. To the End of the Land is published by Jonathan Cape. And that's it for today's podcast. Thanks to Benedicta Page and Sarah Crown for joining me here in the studio. Do join us next week for a discussion of Stephen Hawking's new book and some chat about the Man Booker shortlist. In the meantime, for anyone in danger of succumbing to end of summer blues, the Guardian Saturday Review has just the thing, an essay from the psychoanalyst Adam Phillips on happiness. The Observer's new review will be featuring an interview with one of the writers to look out for in the next few weeks, Claire Keegan. So thanks for listening. I'm Claire Armistead, and the producer is Lucy Greenwell.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.